As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Jonathan Ferro, along with Lisa Abramowitz and Anne-Marie Hordern. Join us each day for insight from the best in markets, economics, and geopolitics. From our global headquarters in New York City, we are live on Bloomberg Television weekday mornings from 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen. And as always, on the Bloomberg Terminal and the Bloomberg Business App.
Bruce Kasman joins us now for more. Bruce, we're going to talk about monetary policy, the Fed, the BOJ. Can we just start on this with America's debt pile? I know you and the team at JP Morgan have talked about the boiling of the frog. Bruce, when does it start to get a little bit too hot?
Well, I think it will get too hot if we're right that the Fed just doesn't have very much room to ease. And over time, that begins to affect balance sheets. It keeps credit tight. It weighs on pricing power. It's a slow-moving story, and I think we have to recognize that so far, the effects of high interest rates just haven't done nearly as much damage as we would have thought to the private sector. So this story is playing out against another narrative, which is to say the private sector is healthy, we're getting supply-side improvement. Hey, maybe we can live with high interest rates and actually generate a soft landing. We've kind of moved from being very much in the boil the frog stance to being agnostic about where this story is going to lead us.
Can you talk to me, Bruce, then about the supply side narrative that the chairman seemed to endorse in the news conference last week? What's the question do you have that sort of linger before fully embracing it?
Well, I think we should embrace it. There's an immigration story which is playing out right now and is boosting labor force growth. It's limiting the pressure on labor markets and inflation from rising jobs. I think we've also generated some pretty strong productivity growth, and that seemed to me to be linked with what we've been doing on spending on R&D and intellectual property. The question is, though, we still have a tight labor market. We have elevated inflation, which I think is sticky. I think, as you mentioned a minute ago, the goods price story globally is shifting here. I'm just not convinced that's going to be enough to get inflation all the way down to what will make the Fed comfortable over the next year or so.
Bruce, we've been talking a lot about the bridge collapse in Baltimore and understanding that it's just one particular port and that potentially other ports can take in some of that traffic. But does this highlight to you that supply shocks have not gone away and that there are these vulnerabilities that will kind of put some sort of floor under this goods disinflation that we've seen for the past couple of years?
Yeah, I think what you're seeing in some sense is a little bit of that, with the idea that there's some new pressures and shipping costs, and this port closure might be part of that. But also you're just losing the benefits of having unwound the dislocations. You know, you've had over the last 6-7 months, U.S. goods pricing, ex food and energy falling at 2-2.5% pace. I think most of the indicators, both domestically and globally, are saying that's going back at a minimum to zero here. You know, so when Chair Powell talks about shelter inflation coming down, I think there's an offset here of quite substantial, maybe even complete, of what's happening in the goods price story. And then that leaves the focus, of course, on inflation very much on how you think about labor markets and other service price inflation, which I think we're going to see is pretty firm when we get the PCE report on prices on Friday.
So taking a step back, this raises the question, and we were talking about it with Mohamed Al-Erian, about whether this is sort of a tipping point for this Federal Reserve in tacitly accepting a 2-point-something or a 2-3% inflation rate for the foreseeable future. Do you think that we have shifted, that this past press conference from the Federal Reserve was really the key moment in that transition?
I think what the Fed is telling us, it wants to start the easing process in the middle of the year, and it's willing to do so even if in the first half of this year it's getting uncomfortably high inflation performance. What I don't think this means is that the Fed is willing to accept on a sustained basis inflation close to or higher than 3%. And what we think is going to happen here is that you are going to see a pivot sometime around the middle of the year where the Fed maybe delivers one or two easing, but it really then starts to shift its guidance. The market today has over 150 basis points of Fed easing priced through the end of 25. Unless the economy gets into trouble, I don't think we're going to see that delivered.
You say they want to cut, which echoes a lot of individuals that come on the program, but they also continue to say how data dependent they are. What would they need to see in the data to actually say, you know what, we're waiting, we're not going to cut this year?
I think that's an interesting point, because as they're talking data dependent, you could see Chair Powell in his press conference really talk as if the bar is pretty high to prevent an easing. So I'm not sure I have the numbers I'd want to be confident about where that is. But I think what they've told us, at least to start the easing process around mid-year, that they're fairly comfortable they've made enough progress. Yeah, there are data prints here that could take them off of that. And I would argue the committee, as you look at the projections, are probably more evenly divided on this issue. But I think the bar is pretty high here. I'm not even sure that if we get a couple of 0.3s on core inflation, which I'd say are high numbers, that that's going to be enough to prevent a June easing. I think it'll stop them from doing much, but I'm not sure it'll stop them from easing in June.
Bruce, there's one inconsistency that jumps out to me, and perhaps we should finish here. How can the Fed simultaneously say we're restrictive and then at the same time embrace the supply side narrative in the labor market, but also point to the labor market as evidence of being restrictive? How does that add up?
Well, I think there's a level issue of how tight the labor market is, and then there's an issue of how much supply side performance is helping it. But I think you are raising an important point, which is that the supply side is improving and helping the Fed, but it is also a signal that the neutral rate is higher. And I think when you look at financial market performance here, it is embedding this idea that some combination of supply side performance, a friendly Fed, and some other things going on here is allowing us to do a lot better with higher interest rates than we might have expected. So I do think you're 100% right here. Policy is not as restrictive as the Fed seems to be suggesting. I think growth will do better if we're right that inflation is sticky. I think they are going to have to change their tune somewhat here, but it still looks to us like they're getting ready to at least start an easing process around mid-year.
It's hard to disagree at the moment. Bruce, thank you, sir. Bruce Kansman at JP Morgan. Going into that economic data on Friday morning.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Amanda Liner with BlackRock expecting cuts to start in the second half and writing this. While a high for longer cost of capital environment poses fundamental pressure for some floating rate borrowers with limited financial flexibility, competition between syndicated and private markets coupled with ample private debt dry powder has encouraged tighter pricing, especially for large borrowers who have access to both markets. Amanda, I'm pleased to say, joins us now for more. Amanda, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you.
The EMP Paribas were with us yesterday and they were talking about a soft landing in credit. Is that your kind of world, your view on things at the moment?
And good morning. Thank you for having me. I did see that interview with Megan yesterday. I think I would agree with that. I think the bar for significant disruption is really high in the corporate credit market. We do, though, expect dispersion. And we are actually seeing that to a pretty significant extent more recently in the U.S., European, and Asian credit markets. Two things I would note. On the point of kind of competition between public and private, I think the way we're viewing it whereas maybe several years ago, if you were a corporate in LevFin, you would have made the decision between issuing a bond and issuing a leveraged loan. Now there's a third option. And so you've actually seen private credit become a viable option for the opportunity set for a lot of corporates. Not every corporate. Not every corporate needs the size to become index eligible in that market. But it is a viable third option. The other point is, I think, on just the terms of having more access outside of the banking channel and the public markets, we believe has been a good thing for corporates. And you actually see that in what I would argue is a pretty muted default rate, given the interest hikes that we've had since March of 2022. And I think that that shows that it's working.
And Bob Michael of JP Morgan was talking about that, the ballast kind of to some of the credit sphere. I do, though, want to just sit on this idea of froth.
Yes.
And that's something that Megan was talking about, that there is this froth developing in tighter credit spreads because of the increased competition. Sounds a lot like the equity market. Exuberance, but it makes sense. So it can go on for a long period of time. Is that kind of what you see?
We see it, and I would say it's not exclusively limited to the LevFin market where there's overlap with private credit. You also see super tight credit spreads in investment grade. To me, actually, it reflects a few things. One is fundamentals are pretty good. Economic backdrop is pretty strong. But if you look at spreads, they look really tight optically. If you look at all-in yields, however, if you going back to the post-financial crisis period, we're talking really cheap levels on a percentile basis. If you were to look at just daily spreads, daily yields back to 2010, yields screen really, cheap and spreads screen really rich. So I think that's part of it, is that the marginal buyer in credit is actually yield-based. So when they're coming to deploy capital, they're not looking at it on a spread versus an index. They're looking at where can I lock in all-in yields. And I think that's fueling some of that optically tight spread measures in credit, as opposed to it's not indiscriminate, because, again, we are actually seeing triple C's lag. We're seeing actually a pretty significant share of credits that are trading above 1,000 basis points in spread. You're seeing dispersion in the single name capital structure, over-leveraged capital structures that are doing liability management. So I would say if it were kind of a rising tide lifts all boats and everything was rallying, I would say we are entering into kind of maybe possible over-exuberance. But we're not seeing that. We are actually seeing some discrimination under the surface.
That's what I really wanted to get into. If I just go over a part of that quote again and just read it out loud for the audience. Competition between syndicated and private markets coupled with ample private debt dry powder has encouraged tighter pricing, especially for larger borrowers.
Yes.
Is it just the larger borrowers? Who's getting left for dead here?
I think it's largely in the high end of the size spectrum where companies have the ability to run dual track processes so they can actually see, okay, again, going back to that point of I've now got this other third viable option, where am I getting best execution? I think the pricing is most competitive at that end. But again, it's not, I do think there's not a sense that folks are being left behind in the sense that that competition is pricing them out. I think what it is doing is it's just changing that mix shift. In late 2023, we saw a lot of public debt being refinanced with private debt. That shifted in the first quarter now that the syndicated markets are open, and we're seeing a lot of private debt actually getting refinanced in the public markets. But those companies need to be ready to be public markets.
Just following up on Megan's point, how concerned are you about weakening covenants, weakening deal terms? Is this something that you see sowing the seeds for something that might not come home to roost this year?
Yeah.
Maybe not in 25, but maybe 26.
Yeah. Well, most of the syndicated market is cov-lite, as you know, on the leveraged loan side. And as the high-yield bond market has become more institutionalized, covenants have become less of a binding constraint in that market, too. It's really the private market that has a lot of the covenant protections. I think the big risk that I'm concerned about for risk asset valuations is a sustained reacceleration in inflation that the Fed cannot deliver at some point in 2024 on rate cuts. Not that that rate cut in the form of rate relief is so game-changing for those credits, but I do think that it's really important for sentiment. And I think that's where you might start to see things really unravel from a risk asset side, is that we don't get any rate cuts in 2024. We're in this extended high for longer into 2025. And I think the key there is if that's happening because inflation is sticky, that is problematic. If rate cuts are very shallow in 2024 because of high growth, I would view that as less of a problem. But if that gets postponed, I think that's an issue.
Just quickly, maturity wall.
Yes.
Red herring or not? Big issue or something to ignore?
I was very concerned about it in the fall of 2023. I think the fact that the capital markets have remained open to lower rated issuers to allow them to get that refinancing done, it's relieved a lot of pressure. In European high yield, it's a steeper maturity wall than the U.S., so I'm watching there.
Interesting. Thanks for that.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
With some making a pivot to hybrid vehicles in China, shares of BYD falling in Hong Kong trading after the EV maker's earnings missed estimates amid aggressive price cuts. Competitor Volkswagen saying it expects to fall behind in China, quote, along with our value over volume growth strategy, we are deliberately prepared to give up market share in order to find a sound compromise between margins and volume. For more, Pablo De Cie, Volkswagen Group of America president and CEO, joins us now. Pablo, good to see you.
Good morning.
Thank you for coming into the studio. I know it's an important couple of days for you and the team here in New York City. I just want to reflect on the events of yesterday in Baltimore, important hub for automakers. Can you walk us through the potential disruptions for you, the team, and the company?
Yeah, first of all, regarding yesterday, our heart goes to the families. It's quite unfortunate that everybody's looking at this. From a business point of view, we are on the side of the sea level. So, you know, when the ships come into Baltimore, we're not going to be affected by this event. Obviously, we're going to have some disruption because of the trucks, but it's not going to be as disruptive as other automakers.
Supply certainly hasn't been the problem in this industry. Unfortunately, it's been demand. Can you walk us through where you're seeing things weaken, where you're seeing things strengthen, and whether you're able to lean into what's happening with hybrids and the demand for it in America?
Absolutely. So let me start talking about the industry. February year to date, the demand is very strong as an industry. The North American market, which is Canada, US, and Mexico, grew 8% February year to date versus last year. And we grew 21%. So we're tripling the growth of the market. But still, 8% is quite strong. And what we're seeing, the data from March, is still strong. Having said that, the EV has flattened. The curve remains around 7.5-8% of the total industry. But we as VW, we still have 12% of our sales are in the ID4, in the electric vehicle space. So we're still having higher growth than the average market.
Do you expect to ramp it up, though, more slowly and maybe put a greater emphasis on hybrids? Are you starting to sort of sow the seeds for that right now because you have a couple of years or potentially months to really get that up and running?
Yeah, so our factory is highly localized in the U.S., and we have both combustion engines and electric vehicles in Chattanooga, in Tennessee. And we're the only foreign automaker that qualifies for the $7,500 credit for the consumer, which means that we're localized within the region. So that gives us our flexibility. Going forward, I think the pace of growth will be slower, but we'll still grow in the EV space. And other powertrains will be a good alternative for the consumers. So the consumers will be able to choose electric vehicles, plug-in hybrids, hybrids, and combustion engines.
How important was that subsidy to you to not only build a factory, but also just in terms of your decision of the product mix to sell?
Well, first, I think the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, is a great piece of legislation for the U.S. because it is transforming the industrial base of the U.S. So you see all these new factories and battery factories being built in the U.S. over the next 3 or 4 years. So the benefit is not only for us, but also for the consumer. You know, by the fact that we're localizing and we're bringing all the jobs of Volkswagen and also the suppliers, you know, we create an ecosystem that provides more jobs here, and then the consumer gets a $7,500 credit.
If Trump were to come back in power, though, he can rewrite those Treasury laws, which makes a subsidy, which could make the subsidy basically impossible to get. How are you thinking about that kind of impact when all this money has been put towards the EV market?
Yeah, so we have a long-term vision on these topics. I mean, we know that, and we believe we remain committed to the EV strategy in the long term, and the pace will depend on the consumer. Now, is it possible that the rules will change? It's possible, but he would need a vast majority in the Congress and the Senate to change these laws. And also, when you look at the map where all the factories are being built, they're not built only in states that are Democratic or Republican. They're being built all over the U.S. I think, you know, in the interest of jobs and growth in technology, I think it would be wise to maintain this long-term vision.
Do you think it would be wise to wait until after the election before you make decisions about your manufacturing footprint in this country?
I don't think so. And I'll give you an example. These are not only words. We decided to localize the ID4 way before the Inflation Reduction Act, which goes back to your question, right? So we believe so much in the transition to electric vehicles and in localizing our footprint in the U.S. that we made decisions before and after that we're going to continue to localize.
One push over the last year or so by this president, by this White House, is to push and support union workers. You mentioned Chattanooga. At the plant, there's going to be a vote on whether the workers join UAW, that specific union. Can you walk us through what that could do to your cost base?
Yeah, first of all, we respect the freedom of our workers to choose how they're represented. Having said that, we're constantly talking to our workers on how to improve, you know, the working conditions, the salaries, and the benefits. It will be up to them how they want to be represented in the future. So we will respect that.
And the cost base, wouldn't you just assume it would increase off the back of that?
I'm not so sure. I mean, we have a very competitive cost base, competitive in terms of the employees. We have wages around $23 an hour, which are comparable to Michigan with a lower cost of living. So we will see.
Pablo, thank you, sir. Hopefully we can catch up again soon. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for the invitation. See you next time.
Pablo Dessy, the VW North America CEO.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast, bringing you the best in markets, economics, and geopolitics. You can watch the show live on Bloomberg TV weekday mornings from 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. Eastern. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen. And as always, on the Bloomberg Terminal and the Bloomberg Business App.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.